It's a great pleasure to be part of a meeting of this type where you really share your ideas with a much more general audience that, than I'm used to. Of course, I mainly talk to not just people in physics, but in my own discipline. And here I'll try to convey maybe a broader idea why we're excited about this. So quantum information really started by people realizing that if you encode information into physical systems, then the laws of information processing depend on the laws of physics. And that's a great news. It's an ego boost to us physicists, of course, because now it's not just that geometry is part of physics, but information theory also, of course, geometry from Einstein's general relativity. So, you know, what kind of geometry the universe subscribes to is a physics question. It's not something you can dream up under a tree or sit on a shore and draw in the sand as the ancient Greeks did, but you have to just measure things in the real universe. Now, the same goes for information. And, of course, I said it was an ego boost, so maybe one day the whole of maths will just become part of physics. I think I'm only kidding. So basically, this goes in the opposite direction. Can information teach us anything? What if information was more fundamental than physics? I think most of my colleagues will probably dislike this direction, but there is a small, hardcore group who believe that there is something deeper than the laws of quantum mechanics. And that's the direction I want to talk about. It explains the mystical title of information without information. I'll just show you how far you can maybe push this idea. So, of course, the whole of physics you can think in terms of information. But somehow quantum physics lends itself much more to the language of information than classical physics. But you can always say physics is really ultimately about making predictions. And so information about whatever system you study is crucial. And it's very important to know two things, and one of them is how much information you have, and the other one is how quickly you can process this information. And then physics, of course, has all sorts of nice ways of illustrating that information is at the core of our understanding. There are all sorts of demons that we like to invoke. Probably the two most famous demons are due to Laplace and Maxwell. So Laplace said, if you give me all the positions and velocities of all the particles, then I will tell you everything that's ever going to happen in the future. So this is a very depressed demon, I suppose. Just knows everything that's going to happen in the future. And the other demon is due to Maxwell, which says, give me all the positions and velocities, the same information, and I will show you how to violate the second. Now, presumably, this is a manic demon. This is a very heavy demon in a way. Because could be the same, of course, demon, manic, depressive in some sense. I'm using a highly politically incorrect language at the moment. But Maxwell's demon basically said, there is this law that says that everything must get worse as time goes on, but actually that's not really quite right if I could have all the information about the particles. Now, this is, of course, all based on classical physics. And it changes very fundamentally when we encounter quantum physics. And so the reason why I said that quantum physics really does look like a theory of information is because one of the main entities is something we call catalog of information. This is what Schrödinger, one of the pioneers of quantum mechanics, called really the catalog of information. And this is, in classical physics, you would call it the state of your system. This catalog really contains all the probabilities for all the outcomes that you might have when you perform an experiment. This is your best knowledge to make a prediction about the future. And so these states of your physical systems are really like betting portfolios. I mean, this is not just an empty analogy. There is much more to that than this, and you will see it in a second, actually. And then the laws of physics just tell you how you should update your betting portfolio. I think this analogy is really almost spot on when we talk about the laws of physics. So I basically write my betting portfolio now, and then in 2 years' time, you know, when they tell me that the interest rates are still very low and so on, I just update my betting portfolio given the knowledge that I have. And this is all there is to physics, if you like. And the way we write these things down, I mean, I think I would really give a talk without almost any mathematics, but basically I just want to show you that the way you write these things down is, if you had, for example, if you were betting on two outcomes, like heads and tails, then you would really use linear algebra and you would say, well, this one there means that I'm really betting 100% on heads here, and this one here means that the tails comes out 100% and heads is zero probability. And we write all our probabilities like that when we have more outcomes than that in quantum mechanics. And then we just keep updating them. Now, the weird thing about quantum mechanics is that you can actually have two of these things existing simultaneously. So when I was saying that you write down probabilities, I think some of you will know that you don't quite write down probabilities, you write something that's called an amplitude. It's kind of a square root of a probability. And so the weird thing, and this is what gives us a few possible technological applications in quantum computation and cryptography, the weird thing is really that in quantum physics we can have both of these things simultaneously. So if you imagine a very simple setup, I mean, this is probably just one slide to convey the core of quantum mechanics to you. If you had a particle like a photon coming from the left, and that thing in the middle is a piece of glass like a mirror, which has a certain probability to bounce off this photon, if you like, and certain other probability to let it go through, then basically when you do this experiment in practice, and this is the weird thing about quantum physics, which is what quite a lot of pioneers of quantum physics didn't really like in some sense, is that there is no way of predicting which of these two detectors will click when you run this experiment. So when you go into the lab, press the button, the photon comes out, it comes to a beam splitter, and now you're saying, okay, which of the two detectors will click? This process is completely random as far as we know. There is no underlying algorithm to predict something like that. You know, Einstein kept saying, I can't believe that God plays dice. And this is why he kept saying that, because he thought there was something behind this. Interestingly for Einstein, one of the most profitable applications of quantum physics is in the casinos of Las Vegas. So God certainly does play dice. And actually, this is used as a random number generator, because it really is more random than anything else you can imagine. All classical random number generators are pseudo-random. There is a code, of course, that generates. And this doesn't have a code, as far as we know. I'll argue even more than that, actually. So why was I saying that actually now we have two things at the same time? Because you could say, well, the photon comes to a beam split and tosses a coin. If it's heads, it goes one way. If it heads, you know, if it's tails, it goes the other way. But actually, we know that it's not like that. Because if we recombine these two possibilities instead of detecting them, and if we have two extra mirrors, one here and one here, and we have another piece of glass of the same type, so 50-50 splitting of this beam, then what happens, interestingly enough, is, well, what you would think would happen is that if there is a random choice between these two parts here, then if the photon goes this way, then it faces another random choice here. If it goes this way, it again faces a random choice. So what I did is I put two random things one after another, so I should surely get something at least as random as what I had before. But actually, this is completely wrong, and the outcome is that the photon, when it's fired here, always ends up in one of the detectors, never in the other one. So this sounds extremely counterintuitive. This is a bit like me asking you, I'm going to toss a coin, can you predict the outcome? And you say, come on, give me a break, it's a random process. And I say, oh, I'm going to toss it twice. And you say, oh, sure, then I know the answer is going to be heads. You count it that big. That's exactly the problem that we have when we are facing understanding the basis of quantum mechanics. And the only answer we have to that is that a photon really goes both ways at the same time. And somehow these two possibilities exist simultaneously. The jargon there is the superposition, basically, of these two parts. And somehow they behave like waves, so that when they meet here, these two waves cancel each other out. They're out of phase, if you like. Whereas these two, coming from this direction and going here, they amplify each other. So basically, that's the only way we know how to reconcile that. But it does, of course, ask you to buy the fact that a photon can exist on both sides of this mirror simultaneously. And I could make this arm as long as you like, down to the edge of the universe. So that really is very spooky. Einstein called it, that's another phrase. He was coming up with all these phrases. He called it spooky action at a distance. So here is basically how we write this state down in quantum mechanics. So we don't have a problem with describing this mathematically, but the outcomes most of the time are really only probabilistic. Unless you have something that I described on the last slide, which you can deterministically do. So basically, here is one catalog of information here, 1 and 0. Here is the other one, 0 and 1. And if I put them together, I will get a joint catalog of information which says it's a little bit in one state and with the remaining probability in the other state. Now, when it comes to quantifying information, in my field, we really stick to Shannon's. I mean, we've heard yesterday that there are many different ways of thinking about information. But we are using the fact that somehow log of the inverse probability is information. And this really makes quite a lot of sense for our purposes. Note that I claim that probability is really fundamental in quantum mechanics, and it makes information in a way more needed in quantum physics than in classical physics, precisely because of the kind of Laplace logic. In classical physics, all the uncertainty is really only superficial. So if you really understood everything properly, all the probabilities would be zero, other than the one for the event that's bound to happen deterministically, classically. So in a way, information theory doesn't even make sense in classical physics. Of course, we use it, but that's for a different reason. But quantum mechanically, you cannot really avoid this conclusion. And then I go back to this betting analogy, which is an interesting one. So this is how you can think about probabilities in quantum mechanics. So Kelly was the guy who wrote the first paper after. So Shannon wrote the paper, and it was really a very complete paper. He had two theorems there on the noiseless and noisy coding. He wrote the paper. It's quite a long paper. It's almost like a mini book. And it was so depressingly well written that no one knew what to say for 10 years after that. It was very bad for his H index, if you like. He would probably be kicked out of our universities these days. There was no citation to that paper. Kelly was the first person, and he said, look, if I was to bet, and if I had some, let's say, a binary process on which I'm betting, like tossing a coin, then the wealth, so he said, if you invest money according to my formula, I don't want to go into details of that, but basically your wealth will grow at the rate of 2 to the number of times you're betting, 1, which is the maximum uncertainty you can have when you know nothing, minus the information that you have there. This information is exactly this information there. So you can see that if I really have a 50-50 uncertainty in something, then this I will itself be 1, and my wealth cannot grow at all. So this says if you have a completely random process, don't bet on it. Don't play lottery. I mean, we all know that. But if it's a little bit skewed, if you have a little bit more knowledge that it's going to be 60-40 heads-tails, then your wealth will grow in an exponential way in this way. So this is this famous, that's why they call it the log optimal portfolio. The people those remaining quantitative analysts in the City of London call it the log optimal portfolio. It's still used, actually. Now, we tend to think about the difference between classical and quantum in the following way, and this is historically, in a way, true. That classical physics describes really large and slow objects in some sense, and it's deterministic, as I said. But quantum physics really came from our need to understand atoms and even subatomic particles. But what's interesting, and what I mentioned here, is that it also really now, we realize, apply to large objects. In fact, we don't know of any limits of quantum mechanics. As far as we know, this table here and myself are also fully quantum mechanical in some sense. I mean, maybe these properties are hidden because of all the noise around us, but in some sense, strictly speaking, we should really be describing everything quantum mechanically. And that means that the message that I had before should also be applied to all of these things. And Schrödinger was the guy who said that entanglement is the key difference. So I want to say a few words about this because it's going to allow me to show you that the way things are created in quantum physics is really out of nothing. I mean, of course, what follows from now on is highly speculative. I want to make it exciting for this audience. I'm outside of my comfort zone now, and you can criticize me, and I have been criticized a lot, so I think that's why I open it for a discussion here. But here is probably the last slide, that last couple of slides that will be really, strictly speaking, physics. So Schrödinger said, what's interesting, and when it really becomes spooky, is when you have two subsystems. And what's interesting is that the information, the catalog of information about joint state of these two systems is most likely in quantum physics not the same as the catalog of information for one of them and separately for the other one. So somehow they are much more interlinked. So it's a little bit like me telling you everything I can tell about my grandmother and then boring you to death about my grandfather after 5 hours, you know, over 5 pounds a day. And at the end of that you say, but can you tell me now something about your grandfather? That doesn't make sense. I mean, if I tell you everything about my grandmother and everything about my grandfather, logically speaking, classical logic would tell you I covered everything together. There's nothing. Quantum mechanics says, no, this is not the same, actually. In fact, the spookiness goes in this way. I can tell you everything about A and B, and yet I've told you nothing about A and nothing about B. And that's the key thing about entanglement. So I can have information about A and B, but I have no information about A individually or B. That's the spookiness there. Now, Einstein, so here is this spooky action at the distance. I chose a grand title, Not in the Mind of God. I'll tell you, I mean, of course, I use it metaphorically like any other physicist. So basically, if you take one of those famous states, if you think of two quantum particles like two electrons, and they have this property called spin. So if you think of one of them as spinning up, then you can have a state where the other one spins down. But what's interesting is at the same time, this state contains the opposite option, that if one is down, the other one is up. And these two electrons or photons or whatever you like to think of, every particle, quantum mechanics exhibits this behavior, can be separated by any distance. So the interesting thing is that you've got one person measuring the state of the particle on one galaxy and getting the state up, and that person knows immediately that the other electron at the other end of the universe is at the state down. And this was what disturbed Einstein, especially because of his theory of relativity. Looks like things are instantaneous. Yeah. As soon as I measure one, then I know the other. And it's actually even spookier than that. I don't have to measure them in the up and down states. I can say, what if I check left and right instead? And then if you measure one of them to be left, the other one will be really anti-correlated in the other direction, and vice versa. And in fact, whatever orientation you check, the twin brother knows, so to speak, to orient in the opposite direction. And so that's the main spookiness that we have in quantum mechanics. Now, can you reconcile that? Now, I would say that most of us would say that the way to reconcile, probably in a way the most logical one, I don't want to claim dogmatically that this is the only one, because there are others, but the logical one is to say that the property of this particle, if you say, what was the spin before I measured it, then a quantum physicist should say it doesn't have a spin before I measured it. Because if it did have a spin, then I could never reproduce this kind of spooky correlation. And that's something that's known as Bell's inequality. So we even have experimental demonstration that if you think there is a local hidden reality underneath, if you think that there is this atom existing here without me probing it, then that's immediately invalidated by this kind of reason. So you cannot have. That's why I said even God cannot know this property. Because if God did, we wouldn't violate those inequalities. And we've been doing it for the last 50 years. So we know this is a strong result. Of course, there are ways out of that. There are ways of saying, for example, that something does propagate faster than the speed of light, but cannot measure. That's an ugly solution to a physicist. There's another solution to that, superdeterminism. When I make the choice of what to measure, I don't really have that choice. I'm predetermined by that. That's also a way of reconciling with this kind of stuff. And physicists don't like to think that we don't have the choice. that's why probably the most favored choice is there is no underlying reality. So somehow the spin value gets created at the moment of pre measuring.
The actor is not there, or it's there and not there simultaneously in the language of
superpositions. So you see, that's the logic that you can now use to say, well, when I make that measurement, I also create information from no prior information, because there wasn't really anything existing prior to that. If there was, I'd be contradicting experimental evidence. So that's the kind of tightrope you have to walk. And of course, you can imagine that this led to endless debates. Probably the most famous debate was between Einstein, who believed in reality out there independently of our observation. So you see, he'd be very strongly against the statement that I made, that certain things don't exist independently and prior to me measuring them. I think this kind of challenges, well, I think it challenges most of us physicists, because we really are realists. I mean, not realists maybe in this naive way, but we do believe that things are out there and we are interacting with them. Bohr had the opposite. I mean, this is sometimes called the instrumentalist or pragmatist or whatever else you like, who said basically physics is really all about describing things. It's not, you know, this almost goes back to the catalog of information logic that I introduced physics. It's all about making predictions. And it's not really there to tell you what nature really is like underneath. And I think this discussion is very much present at every physics meeting, quantum physics meeting that you attend even today. So I don't think we've really resolved this one way or another in some sense. Now, this is this direction that we'd like to follow. I said that realizing that information and physics are not independent is great for information theory, obviously, because you know that you can now pack information more tightly into the same space. You can process it faster, you can have a quantum computer. But the question is this realization also good for physics? Does information theory really tell us anything about physics? And we heard yesterday already of people who claim that information should be at least as fundamental as energy and matter. The question is, can you really push it beyond that? Can you say it's even more fundamental and all other properties arise out of information? And of course, I don't have that. I don't have any answer to that. The closest probably we've come to is an idea by a guy called Carlo Rovelli, who said, well, I think I can really phrase it in an information theoretic way. And he only has two postulates, and they are like this. Postulate number one is that every physical system has a finite capacity in terms of information. So it always has a finite number of bits you can squeeze. And postulate number two is that you can always gain more information about every physical system. So these two almost sound like they're in contradiction with each other. Sounds like one of those Zen accounts, I think, where they give you something that's paradoxical and it's meant to kind of make you shut up, so to speak, and think about the universe. So they're not in contradiction, because in quantum mechanics, like I said, you can always gain new information by making a different type of measurement. And you will always uncover something that wasn't there before, even though the system you're probing only has two outcomes. But the two outcomes could be in all possible directions. So somehow he was arguing that the idea of superposition comes from these two postulates, that you have always a finite number of bits, but you can always get new bits whenever you like. I mean, the paper he wrote is deeply philosophical, and physicists don't really consider it as a rigorous derivation, but I think it's as close as we've come to this idea of physics coming out of information. And now I want to give you a fun slide. I think I'm probably towards the end, and I do want to finish. Yeah, thank you. This goes back again to the title. I think John Wheeler was mentioned yesterday as well. He was the person who really inverted this relationship. Probably he was the first person to write about it. That, you know, so this is the phrase, eat from bit. And he had all these phrases that lots of things in the world appear one way, but if you really look more deeply, they are different than that. And there is a different set of circumstances that gives rise to things. So he would talk about things like charge without charge. Can charge just be a curvature of space-time and there is no really electron out there emitting any charge, so to speak? And the other game he played was dynamics without dynamics. Can it be that the whole world is really static and it looks to us as though there is some dynamics going on? So he was all about this. That's why I called it information without information in some sense. But the game that I want to tell you illustrates probably best how reality arises from no reality is the following game. It's a variant of Wheeler's game as well, in some sense. And this is what we do when we go to a conference and sit in a pub. You can play this game, especially if you want to scare other people off, I think. Then here is the game. So basically, it's usual. It's not a complicated game. Every person has four cards. And you sit around the table, and the aim of the game is really to end up with four cards of the same type. And the first person who does that declares themselves a winner. And so the question is, what are the rules? And there are really only two rules. And the rule is that you can, so you start with one person who can then ask anyone around the table for a card. So for example, you can turn to someone next to you and say, whichever cards you're using, basically. And of course, there is honesty in the game, so the person, if they do have their card, they have to give it up and give it to you. But the other rule is an interesting one, which says you can only ask for a certain type of a card if you already have that type of a card. So you see, this illustrates that when you probe nature, you also give up a little bit of information yourself. So I can't ask you for a king if I didn't have at least one king among my four cards. And then, of course, if the person says, no, I don't have the card, you lose your turn. The person next to you continues and so on. And then you continue to play this game until one person ends up with four cards. And here's the spooky thing. Here's the most interesting thing as far as I'm concerned. And that's the way we play. You actually don't need any cards to play this game.
You literally can start with whatever you like in your hand. I could have a card with an elephant, a snake, and whatever else. It doesn't have to be defined at all. There are no cards. Even though we start with no cards, nothing well defined, we don't have to agree on anything other than the two rules, you will always get one person with four cards of the same type. And you can see how this is going to go, because when I ask you for one card, no matter how ridiculous this card may be, it tells you and everyone else around the table that I have that kind of a card. And slowly you crystallize the few options that you will have as you play this game. So you see, in a way, I think John Wheeler would say reality emerges a little bit like a magician's trick in some sense. There is nothing really underneath, and yet we perceive something out there.
So that's kind of as best as I can convey this logic of information without information. As I said, it's not really something that's strict in the mathematical way, and I can really prove it to you and derive quantum mechanics, but I think that's what it appears to us. Practitioners of quantum mechanics. I think that's my last slide. I think probably the book, incidentally, thank you for mentioning it, but it's a superficial entry. It's a popular book, obviously. If you want to have a little bit more understanding of that, then probably the three reviews that I've written on that are probably the best ones. So this one is really, the first one is really about information and in quantum physics. The second one is about information in many body physics. And then the last one is really about Maxwell's demons and relationship between physics and thermodynamics and information theory. Thank you for your attention.
Well, thanks very much for a splendid start to the second day. We're going to have most of the discussion at the end of this morning's session, as we did yesterday. But if there's any short question for points of clarification or information, yeah, just one or two. There we are.
It's often used the term measurement, for the collapse of the weight. Collapse of the weight.
I think you're right. That's probably at the heart of this discussion. The language I used is that when you make a measurement, you have to update your knowledge, and that changes your catalog of information, if you like, in quantum mechanics. That's one way of speaking. It identifies you already as a supporter of one interpretation of quantum mechanics. There are those of us who dislike the fact that measurement is anything special, and then, of course, you avoid the word measurement and so on, but that puts you in another club of many worlds and so on. So I think these are all issues debated that have not really been resolved in physics.
I simply mean it is clear what is the measurement when it is done by human. How did the work function before?
To a physicist, it's not even clear when it comes to a human, I must admit. And the reason is that if you really apply the same catalog of information to a human being, then the human being joins this quantum limbo of being in two states at the same time, and this never gets resolved. So if the whole universe is quantum, then there are never any measurements in it. So that's the difficulty with this.